You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from the Life is Good Ping podcast. Join the co-founders of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs, as they talk to influential musicians, athletes, business leaders, and everyday people about the role of optimism in their lives. They'll also end each episode with a ping pong charity challenge where the winner gets to donate to their charity of choice. The Life is Good Ping podcast kicks off Thursday, June 13th with the legendary Ringo Starr. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Spotify, or iTunes and add some good vibes to your day. And now, on with the show. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was the incomparable voice of the man considered by many to be the greatest singer that ever lived, opera star Luciano Pavarotti. The legendary tenor blew away opera lovers with his astounding ability to hit 9 high Cs in a row, and later confounded critics when he took opera out of the concert hall and into stadiums. But offstage, he lived an equally operatic life, as seen in a new documentary by director Ron Howard. His film Pavarotti opens in theaters Friday, June 7th, and today the Academy Award-winning filmmaker behind Apollo 13 and A Beautiful Mind joins me on the podcast to discuss his newfound love of opera and of the man who brought opera to the masses, and how he's hoping to carry on that legacy by bringing Pavarotti to moviegoers. Ron Howard talks about the art of filmmaking and storytelling, how the director approaches a documentary versus a narrative film, and how he decided to tell Pavarotti's story as an opera with all the love, heartbreak, and drama that audiences have come to expect. Then we get into Pavarotti the Romantic, how Ron got the various ladies of Pavarotti's life to participate in the film, and why Pavarotti often compared his famous voice to a tempestuous lover. He tells the story of how the three tenors were formed and how opera got the rock star treatment when Pavarotti started collaborating with everyone from Stevie Wonder to Sting, often to the consternation of stuffy opera critics. Plus, we talk about Pavarotti's enormous appetite, his even bigger heart, and Ron's own chance encounter with this opera legend. Coming up with Oscar-winning filmmaker Ron Howard in just a moment. To Today, I'm delighted to sit down with my fellow USC Cinema School alum, Ron Howard. Ron took his film degree and went on to direct 25 movies and win an Academy Award. And me, well, I started a podcast. Ron's latest film is an emotional documentary about the man that many people consider to have been the greatest singer that ever lived, Luciano Pavarotti. Ron Howard, welcome.
You did get one thing wrong.
Oh, did I?
Well, I didn't graduate from USC.
Oh, you didn't graduate?
No. They claim me.
Wow.
And they don't mind if I...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they don't mind if I donate a little money once in a while. And I really appreciate what I learned there, but I didn't make it through all USC. Happy Days came along, and I went ahead and took the job. And for a while, I was trying to do both. I was trying to get to classes and still do the show.
Yeah.
One thing led to another, and finally I parlayed Happy Days into getting an opportunity to direct professionally, and so then it sort of did make sense to go back to film school.
Well, that makes me feel even worse, because now I'm just thinking, what might have been if only I hadn't graduated? So, well, Ron, I was not exaggerating when I said that this was an emotional documentary. I saw it in a screening full of critics, which, as you know, tend to be a pretty cynical bunch. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Wow.
So if any critic doesn't give you an absolute rave for Pavarotti, I'm going to be the guy to call them out and say, you were blubbering right next to me.
Well, thank you. Hey, I'm thrilled by that. And the reaction has just been great to the movie. And I'm proud of the work that we did. It's the same team who all came together to do the Beatles 8 days a week a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we have a really, I think, a good creative chemistry going in terms of delving into the research, exploring it. Paul Crowder, the editor, is a great storyteller in his own right. And Nigel Sinclair, the producer, and Mark Monroe, who's a writer-producer on it. But I think it's all a real testament to Pavarotti. And those who we interviewed, because to an individual, they were defining the spirit of our film. And we're talking about over 50 interviews. They didn't all make it into the final.
Yeah.
But they all suggested a complicated individual. You know, I mean, he had regrets later in his life, the way some of his relationships had ended and so forth. But all that said, the overriding feeling was that this was an extraordinary guy who lived with joy, lived with integrity, you know, and the world, the art form, and all of them as individuals, whether they were family members, loved ones, friends, or colleagues, they just appreciated him. And that came through interview after interview after interview. And while we wanted a warts and all look at the man, the balance, the ratio was kind of defined by the interviews that we were getting.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because when you're directing a narrative film, the director starts out with a vision that sort of guides the whole production. When you're doing a documentary like this, and I think that this is probably your fourth documentary now, do you let the research process guide you where it leads, or does some of your vision work in there from the beginning? Is that baked in?
The late, great director, Jonathan Demme, a friend of mine, we were on the board of a great organization called the Jacob Burns Film Center in Westchester County, New York. And he made fantastic documentaries, music documentaries, and political documentaries as well, as being, you know, an Academy Award winning director. I think he won the award for Silence of the Lambs, but so many great movies. I asked him about it originally, and he really encouraged me to throw myself into it. And he said, and he was so wise about it, he said, you go into a documentary with an idea of the story you think exists there that you want to tell, but you have to be in listening mode. You have to be responding to what you get back, whether you're going out into the field and trying to cover a story or an event, or you're doing a movie built around archives and interviews. And that's certainly what I found to be the case. It's very different than scripted, in that ultimately with scripted, you make the decision. Look, it's more like writing a biography.
Yeah. Right.
Or like Michael Moore makes a documentary, and he's,
he
tells you what he thinks.
Yeah.
He says it.
Right.
This is something else where you're really observing and sharing. And, but you need to have the quotes, you need to have sort of evidence for the points that you're that you're making. I think it's a great addition to my creative life and sort of my exploration of the medium.
So it's a very different process even than when you're doing a narrative film about true events like Apollo 13 or Cinderella Man, Beautiful Mind.
What's similar is the post-production part. And that's where I found I was really able to carry over into the documentary world sort of the same mindset that I apply to the editing of any film, whether it's fact-based or not, which is, all right, here's the material we have. What is this story really yearning to be? What is it? What can it really mean to audiences? I always, when I'm directing, I work very hard on the script with the writers. Sometimes I contribute on the writing in some way, and the producers, but I disconnect from it emotionally when it comes time to direct. Like my attitude is, I don't know who wrote that, but I don't care. What we have is this scene with these actors. How do we maximize this? Then once I get to the editing room, my attitude about what was shot was, these dumbasses, what were they doing? What can this really be? Let's take a look at this footage and really make it into a great story. And so that's that phase is something where I can really take the experiences of my career and apply it to documentaries.
And I definitely think that I see your touch or your vision here in the way that you tell the story of Pavarotti, because for me, it felt like watching an opera. You have the story structure of an opera with the build up to a big crescendo at the end and the emotion, the romance, the tragedy, redemption that we associate with an opera. Was that a deliberate choice of yours to tell that story as an opera?
It was an initial instinct. Well, not very initial, but soon, as I began first to understand how operatic, in fact, his life was. And hey, look, maybe all our lives are operatic. Opera is about, they're dramas about people.
And fundamental basic emotions.
Basic emotions. Yeah. What I began to see when Paul Crowder, the editor, started showing me great performances, there were multiple performances of the same arias, the same songs. But it became clear that at certain points in his life where he was about the age of the event that we were revealing to the audience, talking about in the film, by choosing those performances, you'd get an even greater sense that he was at certain times in his life singing about himself.
That's just like Sinatra did.
And getting started, or older and having regrets, or feeling triumphant, or in love, so that became a kind of a guiding principle. So I'm glad that landed with you, because it was a goal.
And there's a great moment in this film when Bono makes an interesting observation along those lines. Later in Pavarotti's life, he decides to return to fully staged operas, and the opera critics say, "Well, he was better in his prime. His voice isn't what it used to be." And Bono says something interesting. He said, he was better than he was before that because he had been through all of those emotions. So when he was on stage, he really felt it.
He's bringing his whole life to bear. And of course, he was performing Tosca, which is the story of this, an element in the character that he's playing is at a certain point, he's an artist who's ultimately doomed. Ultimately, he knows he's coming to his end. There on his sort of, final tour, it was quite appropriate, and audiences sensed it. I mean, there's this standing ovation moment that we have from this performance on that tour that I find very, very moving. The audience, they just, they're applauding the performance. It's a great performance, but they're also applauding the man.
Yeah. Now, before we get to the voice of the man, I want to talk about his performances and the emotion that went into them that we were just discussing. You've directed, some of the greatest actors of our time, from Tom Hanks to Russell Crowe. How did Pavarotti rank as an actor?
when he was when he was trying to act in some of those TV commercials and things like that, not so good.
Okay, yeah, the old American stress acts, yeah.
But when he was performing, and you look in those eyes, I just really felt like he was pouring himself into it. I mean, mm-hmm. I felt like it is like one of the actors you named, Russell Crowe, totally connecting with a moment. Tom Hanks deeply understanding, mm-hmm. you know, what it is he's playing and feeling it. And other great actors that I've worked with. So I recognized that. I felt like, you know, there's this Pagliacci, the sad clown moment. Right. He was performing it. They did a kind of a special with him where he's really, he's on camera, they're on stage with him. It's almost shot like a movie. And we were able to take that performance, and it's, you know, and it's about your heart's breaking and yet you have to perform. That's mm-hmm. That's what the song's about.
Yeah.
And we placed it. And at that age, he was really going through kind of a midlife crisis, a kind of an identity crisis. And it's very appropriate. And I believe that when he was, there were times in his life when the arias really, really resonated with him on a personal level. You mentioned Sinatra. You know, I do think there are times when the greatest performer just feels a little something more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
with
definitely.
A speech, a yeah. scene, a joke, yeah. or a song.
Yeah.
And we tried to find those performances where we felt like that was the case.
Yeah. You had mentioned that you had done two music documentaries before about Jay-Z's music festival and the Beatles. And you, of course, named your company Imagine, so I know what a big Beatles fan you are. But I didn't take you for an opera goer. Have you always been a closet opera buff prior to this?
No, not a buff. Never a buff.
Okay.
Arrested Development was in Never Nudes. I was probably never a buff. No, it's just the story. I mean, I know more about opera than I knew about Formula One before I did Rush, mm-hmm. for example. But this was really more. I mean, what I could relate to was the journey of the performer who wants to please an audience, who wants to live up to the possibilities of the art form. And what it means to people and what it means to him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the life's journey of somebody who's dedicated to a creative career mm-hmm. Is something that I related to. But I think that mostly I was fascinated.
Yeah.
And I also, as a director, just felt, man, it's a little bit like the Beatles documentary. You could never make a movie. You could never afford to make a movie with that much great music in it. And when you start reading the lyrics of these arias and understanding, you know, what it all means and what it can mean dramatically, it's just a fantastic creative opportunity. It's a tool to try to let audiences be entertained, be transported in a very unexpected, for many people, a very unexpected way. Yeah. Opera lovers understand.
Yeah.
And I hope they recognize all the research that went into making the movie and the respect for the opera as an art form. Mm-hmm. But I think the non-opera lovers are probably the audience that I was really aiming for the most.
Right. And that's the audience that Pavarotti was aiming for.
Yeah.
He wanted to bring opera to the masses. By making this film, do you feel like you're sort of carrying on that legacy a little bit?
I felt that that was a goal, certainly. Mm-hmm. And I think the family was supportive for that same reason.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with filmmaker Ron Howard when we come back in just a minute. Keeping pace with the many changes in technology is critical. Stay up to date and master the tech skills that companies want with a Udacity Nano degree. Udacity's Nano degree programs use the most effective online methods to teach technology subjects from foundational computer programming to artificial intelligence and even how to program a self-driving car. Udacity works with industry experts to design programs that include real-world projects, providing you with true hands-on learning. With experienced reviewers to grade your work, you'll develop a job-ready portfolio that showcases the right tech skills. Udacity's flexible pay-as-you-learn monthly program lets you learn at your own pace, and they'll work with you to create a custom learning plan that fits your schedule. In addition, you'll get personal one-on-one support from technical mentors who can answer your questions and keep you on track. Udacity provides a full suite of career services, including coaching and resume review, to help you land the job you want. Start your future today and be in demand. Go to udacity.com/kick10 and use code KICK10 to save 10%. That's udacity.com/kick10, code KICK10 to save 10% today. And now, back to the podcast.
The critics and some of the more diehard opera fans often criticized him for going and taking it out of the opera house into just live concerts and then arena concerts, the three tenors, and then, heaven forbid, performing with rock stars. Yeah. Do you think he cared much about that? Did he seek their approval? Did it matter?
I think it's that paradox. Mm-hmm. I think he did care. In some of these interviews, you sort of see in him, there's a little anger, you know, because he mentions I was always criticized. So, of course it hurt. Of course, he wanted to be better understood than that and respected at all times. But if what he had to weigh was follow the conventions and expectations of a select group of guardians of the medium as it's been understood for years, or venture out, take some risks, take some chances, stretch myself in that way, perhaps have some fun, and get opera out there into the world. And I think he was willing to take the bad with the good. I think the scales for him tilted toward this other kind of experience, which, by the way, was also invigorating for him. It fueled his philanthropic efforts, right? Expanded that, and creatively, he was getting to hang out with Bono. He was getting hang out with Mariah Carey and people. You know, I mean, it was, I'm sure, stimulating for him and a blast.
Yeah. Now, we have to talk about that incredible voice some more. And I also want to applaud the sound design of this film. And I have to confess that I'm that guy who asked, can't you send me a screener link for the movie?
The
studio said, you have to see it at theater with Dolby sound. Otherwise, you're just not going to do him justice. And they were absolutely right. I was so glad I did, because I've heard many of these songs probably 50 or more times over the years on my home stereo or in the car. But when I was in the theater, I don't know what kind of magic you worked here, but it felt like I was in a concert hall acoustically.
Well, that was the goal. And it's the same mixer who I've worked with many times before. He's an Oscar winner, Chris Jenkins. Hollywood composers love it when you get Chris Jenkins as the mixer. He's great with music in addition to everything else, sound design. When he heard I was doing this, he reached out. We'd had a great experience on the Beatles 8 days a week. It was almost out of superstition that he wanted to mix the movie at Abbey Road again. So we did.
Wow.
But there was a kind of a stroke of good fortune there because we were mixing. And he went into the big recording stage at Abbey Road, and they were set up with mics all over the room, and he found out that the London Symphony Orchestra was going to be recording there the next day. And the light bulb went off for him. And he that night, he was able to go in and use their mic setup, and he re-recorded some of the tracks of Pavarotti singing and some of the tracks of the orchestra playing, stripping them out and separating them as best he could, and then remastered all of that so that it would have an even more symphonic quality,
sort
a room
of a
tone,
3D effect.
It had a room tone, so it was a lot less about digital and a lot more about really careful. Re-recording and using, you know, real mic relationships and spatial relationships to the sound to help with that.
Yeah.
And then certain moments, you know, triumphant moments, climactic moments in the music. You know, we certainly used everything in the old Dolby bag of tricks to try to get the hair to raise up on your neck.
Yeah, it sounded just fantastic, and it really, I think, did him justice. And one thing about Pavarotti that I found interesting is in one moment in the film, he describes his voice as a woman, or in terms that one would describe a female.
Yeah.
He says, you know, I have to be careful with her sometimes. Sometimes I have to coax her out. Sometimes she loves me. Sometimes she doesn't love me. Sometimes she's very stubborn.
Yeah.
As a man who loved passionately and had two wives and lovers and two daughters with whom he had somewhat strained relationship at some point, I have to imagine that he understood as well as anyone the double-edged sword of that analogy.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure that he did. He's a very romantic guy, but romantic about life.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about love and romance, or a kind of romance for going to China, a romance for singing in the rain to Princess Diana and 200,000 people. I think that he lived a big life. If I could meet him and talk to him, I think the question I'd want to ask would be, how were you shaped by opera, not just as an art form and a discipline, but by the narratives of opera, the big sweeping storylines, the drama, the highs and lows? Do you think that influenced you at all, or do you think it's just a natural, organic fit?
Yeah, that'd be an interesting question. And you play on this idea in the film of that voice being something of a blessing and a curse because of everything that comes with that particular talent, the celebrity, the entourage, and all that. To me, it almost seemed like a cruel cosmic joke to give this incredible voice to a simple Italian peasant, as he would describe himself, who was completely unequipped to deal with modern celebrity and sort of left to navigate all that on his own, don't you think?
Well, look, it's there's so many stories in the entertainment world of individuals who come from hardscrabble lives.
Mm-hmm.
His was a small village in post-war Italy. You've got, kids coming out of the ghetto, whether they're athletes or they become great music stars or actors. You got people coming off of, dirt farms who, suddenly have these careers. And so it is art, that ability to express an idea to audiences in ways that reach them more deeply than most people. There is something about that, and those people coming from less advantaged circumstances, that is that sort of paradox.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause suddenly they're earning people's respect, their love, and with it, a lot of money often. And by the same time, they're just not very well equipped. So it was another one of those stories made very particular because, it's all happening in the erudite world of opera, and even opera wasn't supposed to afford that kind of wealth.
Yeah.
But because he did have this charisma and he did have this ability to sort of take it to the people and broaden the reach of the genre, he made vast sums. So, there is real irony in that. But again, there are a lot of twists and turns in Pavarotti's life, and I suppose that's one of the reasons we were attracted to it.
And it also created sort of a gulf between Pavarotti and his first wife and his two daughters, because here he was traveling all over the world, performing to audiences of tens of thousands. Meanwhile, the family is staying back in Modena, Italy. As a director, you might be on location for several months at a time. Can you relate to that a little bit?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I can relate to being lonely and isolated and away from your family, but we just handled it very differently. Cheryl and my family went with me everywhere.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, but I wasn't on these kind of road trips where, one night here and two nights there.
Yeah, that's gonna be rough.
That's a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And athletes, baseball, basketball players, anybody with a long season, rock and roll acts, musicians, marriage is tough under any circumstance. And I think their relationship fell prey to that same kind of division. However, make this point, Catholics in Italy, and a famous Catholic at that, divorce was, not really a very realistic option for many of those years. And even when he did finally divorce and take the leap, it was extremely embarrassing for everybody and painful. So, the specific culture that he came from only intensified the drama of that of those challenges.
Yeah, and as a result of that, when he remarried, he couldn't, of course, marry in the Catholic Church, so he ended up marrying in an opera house.
Yeah, right? Which was another little twist and turn. Yeah. He was interestingly, by all accounts, he didn't live that kind of rock and roll life. Mm-hmm. Yes, he had relationships, he had romances and things like that, but it seemed to be he was more a serial romantic than anything else. And he ate, but he drank some, not a lot, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't live a rock and roll life. He was protecting that voice. And so it's interesting. There's some parallels to any great, rock star or musician. And then in some ways, he just had to live very differently.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that enormous appetite, one of the fun moments in the movie is you see all of the food he would take from his village along with him on the tour. He'd bring pounds and pounds of pasta and Parmesan. One of the things I've always wondered about him is, did that weight, which I think at one point ballooned to like almost 400 pounds, did that affect the voice? Is this trope of the fat opera singer true? Does that matter?
We didn't delve into it, and we never got anybody who really would talk about it. We had one great clip where this one woman says, do those huggable extra inches give you that deep voice? And he says, I think so, as a joke, gets a huge laugh. But I would think not. I would think he could have weighed 100 pounds less and still been the king of the high seas.
And as if he wasn't the biggest star already, he then joins forces with two other great men of opera, José Carreras and Plácido Domingo, to form the Three Tenors, which at their height, they were like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. How did that whole collaboration even begin?
Well, it began in a very noble, collegial way. José Carreras had come back from a near fatal disease, a bout with leukemia, I think it was, and sort of wanted to get back into performing, but needed to just do it cautiously and slowly. Somebody brought the idea to Plácido Domingo and Luciano Pavarotti that maybe they could do a concert, or something with José Carreras. And everybody just agreed to do it one night as a kind of a welcome back. And they just so rocked the place and rocked the world that they became an act. It was sort of an outlier moment where who would have guessed that the world would awaken to the power of opera? Mm-hmm. And yet, these three geniuses performing together generated a kind of sensation. Not just a marketing sensation, but a sound sensation that was unique and just reminded people all over again, how powerful opera can be.
And opera singers can be notorious divas. I have to wonder, you interviewed Plácido and José Carreras in this film. Did either of them indicate that there were any egos or any kind of competitiveness between them?
I mean, they both just said no. It just was.
Really?
It came so easily. One thing we didn't get into in the film was that there was some sort of business fallout as to, deal splits and stuff like that. Uh-huh. But that was not, it didn't have much to do with Pavarotti, the man or the music. So we didn't delve into it. But of course, that's, that kind of thing always happens. They had such affection for him. They were both unbelievably busy guys, and they made time to sit down and talk about it. They wanted to be a part of it. Just like Bono, we tried to get him to work with us and talk about the Beatles, who he adores and loves. We never could schedule the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? But Pavarotti,
he made himself available for Pavarotti because that's he loved him. They all, again, they all recognized that he could do things that would bug them. He could do things that would even dramatically disappoint them. And in some instances, really heartbreaking, relationship schisms and things like that. But what's the headline in every instance? It's, what a remarkable individual, and the world's better off for him having been here.
Yeah.
And that he was a good man, ultimately a good man with a good, maybe he made some mistakes, but he was a giver, not a taker.
Yeah, and the last chapter in this film really drives that home when he just throws himself into charity. And you see just this essential humanity of this person. And he just loved people, not just rich people or famous people, not just opera goers, but fans, service workers, secretaries, kids. He was a big kid himself. He just had this enormous, enormous heart. You met him, I believe, at one point in your life. Get a glimpse of that?
It was in a huge kind of mob scene situation, Golden Globe party or some kind of thing like that. He was clearly like the event that he was there. He wasn't even performing. He just sort of walked around in his scarf and his fedora and said hi. You could sense the charisma. But he was one of these people, by all accounts, that just knew how to make people feel at ease, you know? Knew how to connect, wanted to connect. That's not a manipulation. That's something that you choose to do because it's better for you. It's easier for you to really make eye contact, make people feel comfortable because you want to feel comfortable, you know? Yeah. And so I don't think he was faking or wearing a mask. Or I don't think he was disingenuous. I think he wanted to feel good. He wanted to make other people feel good, and then that would rebound to him. And I think that's the way he lived his life.
Yeah. Well, before we go, many have called Pavarotti the greatest singer that ever lived. What do you think? Do you think that's true?
I don't know enough about music to say. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I others are saying it. I bet they're right or close to right. He certainly gives me goosebumps when I listen to him.
Yeah, me too.
That's not the reason I was making the movie. I wanted to tell the story because I thought it would offer insight in a few fresh, original ways, and I thought it could remind people or inform people just what a great art form opera really is, and how misunderstood it can be, and also to take a moment to celebrate because it is a celebration ultimately. When people talked about disappointments or so forth, we included that in the movie. But ultimately, the upshot is it's a real celebration of somebody who lived life really with gusto. And I think that there's a lesson in that. And that would have been my takeaway.
Yeah.
I'd say is that when you live your life constantly trying to kind of maximize the experience, share the joy, bring joy to others and feel the benefits of that, that's going to wind up being a rich, fulfilling life, well-lived.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, congratulations on such a beautiful film. I really highly recommend that everyone see it. Pavarotti opens in theaters Friday, June 7th. Ron Howard, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks again to Ron Howard for coming on the podcast. Don't miss his documentary feature, Pavarotti, opening in theaters Friday, June 7th. Master the tech skills that companies want in today's landscape with a Udacity Nano degree. Udacity's flexible pay-as-you-learn Nano degree programs include expertly designed real-world projects that fit your busy schedule. You'll also get one-on-one support from technical mentors and a full suite of career coaching services in your program. Start your future today and be in demand. Go to udacity.com/kick10 and use code KICK10 to save 10%. That's udacity.com/kick10, code KICK10. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.